Well, the transition's scary when you go off on your own.
Oh, it is.
I know that the first initial thought for anybody in that position is, I get to do what I want, make my own schedule.
Mm.
But you're literally writing your own story at that point.
Wrong. So today we talked to a guy named Jannard Archibald. So I met Jannard many years ago when we first started Table and Time. And to be honest with you, he was the weird guy always carrying around a camera. And he was a content creator before the word was really just mainstream. And so what Jannard has done is he's perfected and just constantly created his craft. He's one of the best content creators on video that you've ever seen. So as soon as this is over, you need to go track him on all the socials and see all his video. I would say this. He's got a video where him and his wife were in Iceland. It's absolutely wonderful. It will almost bring tears to your eyes. And I'm not a very emotional guy. So you need to track this guy down and follow him. But what we're going to get into today is his journey through growing up here in Birmingham. His parents are from Grenada, but growing up here in Birmingham. But then going to film school and just all the things that he's done. I met him when he worked for some people. Now he's co-founder and founder of about three different businesses now. So that's why he's here on the owner's table. One of the things that's really, really common about everybody on this pod or that everybody that watches is that you're probably really, really good at one or two things. And you really, really work hard. This guy, everything that I've seen of Jannard is an extremely hard worker. And he's wonderful at what he does. You can go on his Instagram and really get addicted and just watch all of his stuff. And I know he's got more content after. Jannard, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. I felt like I was a bird flying hearing all that stuff. I almost need to have you coach me up in the morning.
That's right.
I need that to be my alarm clock.
I'll be your hype coach.
Yeah. Just like, I won't even snooze that. I'll just like let it go. I'll be like, I'll probably float out of bed.
Let you. Oh, man. So tell me this. So you grew up in Birmingham, mm-hmm. went to Oak Mountain, which is high school right around the corner. So tell me, when you were growing up, when people said, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? What'd you say?
Oh, man. I mean, I think the first thing that came to mind was a doctor, because that's what my dad was.
Okay.
Very successful, very talented, and respected psychiatrist in Birmingham, and actually just all over the state, because that's what he does. And you know, you don't really know what you want to be.
Sure.
At least I didn't.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, I mean, it wasn't until, I mean, you kind of guess what you want to be. That's what I feel like it is. It's
right.
Like, hey, what do you want to be? It's like, for me, I wasn't, you know, engineered at that time to know. I feel like I'm a late bloomer in a lot of things.
Me too.
When it comes to like what I want to do, when I want to start a family. Like I had ideas and some goals of what I thought. But like at the end of the day, I didn't know who I was.
Yeah, sure.
I feel like I just figured out who I was just like 4 or 5 years ago.
There's nothing wrong with it. Nothing at all wrong
you
with
know,
that.
You're just kind of guessing the whole time. So to answer your question, did I know what I wanted to do? Man, absolutely not. I felt like I was kind of thrown into this path based on the fact that I didn't do well academically in school.
Why is that?
Dyslexic.
Yeah.
And I was also told I was diagnosed with a speech impediment, which now it makes sense why when I was in school, I had a hard time not just reading, but saying words, any words, normal words.
Yeah.
You know, you probably can't tell now is because I've, you know, when you practice and you learn as much as you do growing up and dealing with a speech impediment or just dealing with being dyslexic, you figure out how to master the core words. But if there's a word that I've never said before, I mean, I'll butcher it, you know?
Really?
Yeah, completely terrible. But yeah, school is really hard. You know, school's one of those places where I feel like a lot of kids are proud to go to.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, I'm so smart. And a lot of kids are smart by default.
Sure.
But I feel like, you know, by default for me, I always felt like I had to work three times harder.
Mm.
Just because of how this thing works.
Yeah.
And I didn't ever really understand that, you know, getting put in classes that were, you know, I need more extra time.
Do you have an IEP? Didn't?
Uh-uh.
Not in high school? Huh.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
So diagnosed as dyslexic. When did they diagnose you as that?
I want to say I was probably in like fifth or sixth grade.
So past reading stages.
Yeah. I mean, when they were like, he's got a second grade reading level at fifth grade, you know? So, I mean, that was like the hardest
thing. Do you read now?
I don't. I mean, I listen to books on tape.
Yeah.
The readings that I do are about camera equipment and
figuring out how to use things and different things like that, manuals.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me this. We talked earlier off camera, really good swimmer in middle school and growing up, but like the football and the basketball, that wasn't your jam just because your dad said, hey, you know, I don't think that's the best thing for you. So when did you pick up a camera first?
My dad actually had some old cameras. I think my grandfather is like where I get the art from.
Okay.
He's also an entrepreneur. He was very successful in Grenada, even though that island is only like 400 square miles.
Yeah.
For importing and exporting and having a grocery store and all that. But like he hobbied and shot with some film cameras and then ended up giving one to my dad, which I think he was like, oh, thanks for this camera.
Yeah.
He graduated from medical school there. And then eventually I got it, you know. Huh. He was like, hey, you want to try this out and see if it's your thing? And, you know, at this time, you know, I'm art in school was not something that you could choose as a career.
Sure. No. We're not, I'm not much older than you, so, yeah. But you're right.
Like, yeah. Doctors, no, lawyers, yeah.
Teachers,
nurses.
Like, everybody wanted to be a professional football player or yeah, whatever, but yeah, like, yeah.
A lot of.
No one wanted to, I want to be an artist when I grew up.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Exactly. And I didn't have any, I almost felt like I was called to it because I couldn't do anything else, you know? It was just one of those things where
by
I was,
default.
You know, I, you know, picked up one of my dad's old VHS, like Sony. I remember it's called the Sony Handycam.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, we had some projects for health that, you know, we had to put together a video. You know? And then I started diving into like iMovie and, you know, I had my group and nobody knew anything, but I had already started shooting. And so I was the guy that shot, directed and edited like this ecstasy commercial about like, or infomercial for, you know, why and what it does to your brain. And I mean, I went crazy artsy. I went like just.
That's incredible. Just, in high school.
Yeah, in high school. I was 9th grade. And then when we played it, it was interesting because, like, you know, ours played last. I don't know why ours played last, but.
Praise God, it didn't play first.
Yeah.
All those schmucks behind you.
everybody had played theirs. And I, you know, I'm nervous because I've never really put my video up against anybody else's yet. And it was as, you know, as basic as it can be. Like, I felt like a lot of, you know, kids just, you know, they recorded. There was no thought or intention behind
sure.
the cuts and, like, the angles. And I just kind of did that on my own and didn't even realize that, like, oh, I use slow motion. And, you know, I picked up on, you know, when the door opened or if this person, like, overdosed. Like, I went to this, like, euphoria state
right.
and just went a little weird with the music and, you know, it was dark and then it was light. And I remember my teacher at the end, she pulled me aside and was like, that was great. That was fantastic. And she used it for an example for several years after I left.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in high school. Did that instance kind of give you the bug of like, hey, I think I'm pretty good
at this?
I think
I just got lucky at that time.
Yeah.
You know, like you also have to think too, I've struggled academically all the way up until this point. Why would this be the thing that now is like in like for my brain and for my soul that like this is the thing that like is going to be the door that opens? Because I'm still thinking like I can't get paid for this.
Sure.
You know,
maybe not at the time, but man, I mean, if you had a kid, 9th grader right now, you're like, heck yeah, what can we do to help this kid do this?
Even just like a kid that's 7 years old that you start seeing, you know, making interesting videos or unique videos creatively just on my phone or, you know, and I'm like, whoa, what you got here?
Yeah.
You got some talent.
Well, the phone right now is, you know, 100 times more powerful than that handy cam you had. 100%. I mean, you can do everything there.
Oh, 100%.
You can do everything there.
Yeah.
So you went to film school.
Mm-hmm.
Very atypical.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad being a doctor,
mm-hmm.
when you decided to go to film school, what did he say?
Honestly, it was my parents that saw that I was interested in it, and they found it.
Wow.
And
that's awesome.
They also realized, I mean, as embarrassing as this may sound, this doesn't bother me, actually, but my, you know, I couldn't score high on my ACTs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I took it like 4 times and still couldn't like get into Auburn or Alabama.
Okay, I've got to ask this question.
Because that's where all my friends are going.
What did you make on the ACT? Because this can't...
It was like a 17.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure I scored a 15 on it the first time.
So.
And I'm pretty sure they... And the most heart-wrenching thing about it is like they said that you could literally fill your name out and get a higher score than a 15. So
you know what I made?
What?
I took it 3 times.
Yeah.
I made a 17.
Okay.
Then a 16.
Yep. We're in the same boat.
Then an 18.
Yeah.
And I had to combine them together to get a 19. And I was still on probation at UAB.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I got in because I had a 3.2 GPA.
Didn't have that. I purposely, I think senior
that's so funny. He talks about how bad he did. I did the same thing he did.
Junior year. I knew at the beginning of senior year that I was going to go to Full Sail because I couldn't test. And I actually, you know, purposely failed my first period so I could go to Chick-fil-A every morning. I was a bit rebellious too.
Wow.
I did not like school. I remember English was my, you know, my most difficult subject. So I remember any time the new year started, teachers would, you know, they'd call on you, you know, yeah. read. And every year I had a plan. I had a formula since I was like in fourth grade. I would go to the teacher at the very beginning of class, first day of school, English, and be like, I have this disadvantage and I don't need you to call on me. And
did it always
most
work?
Of them, partially until my senior year. You know, I'm like, senior year, rolling in, gonna have this conversation. And she was like, all right, thank you, Jannard, for letting me know. We get into class, you know, I'm feeling comfortable. I'm at the front of the class because Archibald, you know, you sure. go in order. And she says for everybody to pull out your American literature book. Pull it up to, I think it was like Canterbury Tales and the Beowulf stories and yep. all that. And I didn't know anything about this, obviously, because it's my first year getting into American literature. And she asked people to raise their hand to read the first passages. And of course, I'm not going to raise my hand. I just had a conversation. She understands the plan, right? And she calls on me.
What?
And she has me go to the front of the podium, and she has me read the entire first story. And I remember feeling so scared and messing up on words. But for some crazy reason, that class, there wasn't that, you know, that a-hole.
Yeah, sure. There.
And people almost kind of felt for me.
Yeah.
And then I found like a stride at some point, like maybe like three quarters or halfway through where I scared myself enough that I went numb that I was like, I'm in this.
Yeah.
Right. And it was great. It was really, really great. I was able to push through. And then from now, and she pulled me aside after class. I was like, why did you do that? Why did you choose to embarrass me? And she was like, I just need you to, I think you can get past this.
Wow.
I had anxiety going to that class, second period, every day.
Wow.
Every day going to school.
Mm.
But it ended up being
the hard
really
thing.
Good for me.
You pushed through the hard thing.
She ended up being my favorite teacher.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you go to film school, In Orlando, what's it called? Full Sail?
Yeah,
so
weird full, name.
Full Sail is a real name. Yeah. Full Sail
University. So they did get accredited. I know at first they weren't accredited for a while. It was a for-profit school. That's what everyone called it. But the reason why my parents thought it would be good for me, even though it was outrageously expensive, was that everything was hands-on.
Mm.
We had our four core classes, but everything was hands-on. We built film sets from the ground up.
That's awesome.
Lighting classes, directing. I mean, it was all very, very intentional in terms of real-world experience. And, you know, there was a lot of times where, you know, being in... It wasn't like you got vetted to get into Full Sail. You didn't have to apply then. You just had to have... Sally May loan, which I just paid off this past...
Wow.
Was it last year? Parents helped out a lot. I had to put some money towards it. But
how much was it back then a year?
I think the film program and everything with living expenses, I mean, it was like $125, $130.
A year?
No, sorry, for the whole tuition. But it was 2 years. 2 years, $120, accelerated.
So 50 or 60 grand a year.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is expensive. All right, so you get out of there. What do you do when you get out of there?
I think that I'm going to be a big shot director / movie editor, move back home, you know, hang out with my girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, because I was also very relationship driven. I don't know why, but every person I dated, I thought they were going to be my wife, which is absolutely silly.
It is.
Because I would prioritize like my life mainly to that idea.
Sure.
But couldn't find any work. So I graduated in 2008.
Okay.
So I started in 2006, Full Sail, which is insanely weird. People don't really get this, but it works. They're accredited because of the time and the core classes that you have to accomplish, but you do 8 to 12 hours a day.
Like, are you kidding me?
That's the formula.
But you know what, though? They're getting you used to the real world.
Yeah.
And it's like, I tell people this all the time. So here's where Full Sail and Highlands College are really similar. is these kids have their core classes, but they go to a practicum class, I think twice a week. Twice a week. And then every Sunday, those kids are working 8 or 10, 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And whatever it is, they're going to go do. So it's as hands-on
mm-hmm.
and as real life as it can be. They're teaching them, but from week one, mm-hmm. they're doing the thing that they think they want to do.
Yeah.
And that sounds like what this program was.
Yeah, and at first it was a little weird, but I'm a night owl. Like, I don't sleep. So when we got a 12-hour day, and it's a 24-hour school too. So, like, sometimes our classes start at 1 a.m.
What?
Yep. And then you just had to get your sleeping figured out. Because in the industry, you don't...
Whoa. Yeah. Say that again now?
Yeah, classes would start at 1 a.m. sometimes. That would be the call time. And you'd have to be there, and you'd build a film set or whatever, and then you'd go until, you know, 1 p.m. the next day.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, I guess it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's like I learned...
It wasn't like that every time.
Yeah, sure.
It was just like some advanced lighting mainly the lighting classes and the set development classes.
But yeah. What they're doing is they're getting you ready. I remember one time I was just moved back to Birmingham, and I talked to a guy, and he was kind of a mentor to me for like 6 months. He worked at the church, but he was helping me get set up and everything. And he said, "How you doing with hiring people?" I go, "I mean, it's going fine. It's going fine. I got a lot of people who won't show up. You know, when they said they're going to come in." He goes, "Here's what you do. I used to run a factory for 20 years. Mm-hmm. He said, "The first year, I always had people come in at 9 o'clock to meet me and see what they're going to do. And then at the end of the interview, I'd say, 'Hey, yeah, we start next week, be here at 4 a.m. He goes, "They look at me like I was crazy and I wasted my time." So he said, "Here's what I did. They had to be here at 4 a.m. to start their shift at their work." He says, "I met them at 4 a.m. to do the interview. Because if they're not going to get up for an interview at 4 a.m., they're not going to come to work." So he always had them come in at whatever time that it was, just to vet them out, I guess. Yeah. And that's honestly what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, it got me, I got some calluses, you know, kind of built in for me. So, like, it didn't really scare me. But, yeah, to answer your question, 2008, you know, the market crashed in 2008. I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
In the market. They're like, "Oh, the market crashed 2008. Right. Yeah. We're in a recession." I'm like, "Yeah, great. What does that mean for me?"
Sure.
It means that every single place that I applied to, which, like, I applied everywhere here, all the local news stations, and, you know, anything doing with video, nobody, every single person said I was overqualified.
Sure.
And I didn't have enough experience, which was like, and that time, now that I think about that, I was like, just say that you don't want to pay me or you don't have anything available. That's fine. But I mean, dude, I was humbled real quick. And I also looked at my dad and a successful doctor and said, "Hey, are you going to get me a camera to help me start my business?" And he was like, "No, you can go work at McDonald's.
Wow.
You can live under this roof and find work." But, you know, and my pride got in my way so much because I'd be damned if I had to work.
Yeah.
I just got my film degree. I'm going to be a film director.
Sure.
I'm ready to shoot, you know? And so that was a real reality for me.
So what did you do?
I started shooting weddings for free. I brought some of my friends were able to they were getting married and they were like, "I believe in you." Actually, one of the first wedding I ever shot, one of the folks was one of my good friends, Jamie Little. That's not her name now. But she was getting married, but she was a part of that health class video that I did.
In the ninth grade.
And she was like, "Janard, I love your work. I want you to shoot my photography for the wedding and whatever." And in my mind, I'm thinking, I went to school for film. I don't need to be shooting pictures, which, you know, essentially it's the base.
Sure.
It's photography. And so I think at the end of the day, I needed to go through that journey to appreciate a single frame.
Mm.
And like what that means to tell a story and be humbled that I just wouldn't get any money from it.
Sure.
And it taught me how to look at love, people, body language, energy, study that. And I did that for as long as I could, even though I was doing it for free. I was also I got a pretty sweet job. I didn't pay too much, but I got to make my own schedule for Hewlett Packard to go into Walmarts to train Walmart associates on those instant print machines that are always broken.
So that was your first real job?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about that?
Just traveling all over
the
state.
Not shooting a camera.
Nope.
No camera, no nothing. Just I got to get money in.
Yep.
And I think I tell people this all the time. Is like, you got to figure out a way to make money,
mm-hmm.
number one, and then work on your thing mm-hmm. outside of that. Because if you want that thing bad enough and you're good enough at that thing,
mm-hmm.
you'll eventually make money at that thing, but you got to pay your bills.
Yeah.
So you're helping people print pictures at Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Which, like, it was so hard for me because, you know, and I guess the benefit there, too, is I got to print all my wedding pictures off for free for my clients.
That's right.
But I was still in that world somehow. Even though I was in Walmart, I was still surrounded by a printer. And even though it didn't really seem like it was in my world, just because we're in Walmart and these people are complaining about their cards not being read, and right. I've got to assist them and train the employees on how to, you know, fix these machines and train them on it. But, you know, I did that long enough to where, you know, I could save up to get my first camera, my first, like, photography camera, which rolled into some of that free wedding photography.
What was your first camera that you bought?
It was a Canon T3i. It was $500. It came with a plastic lens. And I just remember realizing that once I got that it was going to be everything I needed to keep going. And then I started learning that I needed some lenses. Mm-hmm. And the lenses were more than the camera.
The camera.
You know, like my first real lens was, you know, $2,400.
Oh, my stars. And that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I didn't have any insurance. So you drop that, and they're still that expensive. So, and that specific lens right now, if you were to buy it, it's still going to be in the same price range, brand new.
Wow. So let me go back to this. You said something I thought was interesting. Do you recommend video creators start with photo?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Why?
Because at the end of the day, video is, I mean, what we're shooting on right now, we're probably shooting it, it's 24 frames per second.
Okay.
So every second that we're here and it's capturing, there's 24 frames in it. And that frame is a single image. And if you can get to the micro version of it and the just like look super small and think about framing and composition and lighting, then you're going to be like a superhero when it comes to video.
Wow. That's interesting. I never thought about that. So you're working at Walmart, setting up printers. You like that? You like that?
No, it's because it's the truth.
You're working at Walmart,
yeah,
setting up printers for people, selling pictures. What was your first video creation paying job?
So this is a random thing too. In between all of that, I did intern at Rick and Bubba.
Okay. If you don't know what Rick and Bubba is, if you're listening to this in some other country, Rick and Bubba are two dudes that are from Alabama who are just wonderful, God-fearing people.
Amazing.
That are absolutely hilarious, but it's all Southern fun humor, and it is all ad-lib.
Yep.
They're just two dudes.
Yeah.
And there's a couple guys in the background, but it's just two dudes talking. Yeah. And it's a syndicated radio show. Mm-hmm. And they're huge within probably, 400 or 500 miles of here.
Oh, amazing.
They're so much fun. So you're interning at Rick and Bubba.
I'm interning, and I'm the guy that runs the phones. And every now and then, they'll let me get the video cameras, the nice ones that they have, because they got some nice ones, and shoot something like a recap, an event or something like that. But mainly my job title, as much as I try to get out of it, was phones. You know, you're in the booth. And you get the phone calls coming in, and I'm still dyslexic and have a hard time spelling and all this other stuff. So when people are calling in, I'm like, can you spell that? What location? You know, like, and because whatever I type in, they see in real time on the screen, and they get to pick those calls. I remember there was just because my brain, the anxiety of being in that position and being live, there was this one girl that called and said that she was with Chris Rock. And that Chris Rock wanted to be on the phone. And I typed that in. I was like, Chris Rock on the phone, Scottsboro, Alabama. And, you know, Rick hits the button to take it in. It's like, all right, this says Chris Rock's on the phone. Apparently, it was Chris Wright. I didn't even hear her say it. She said something completely different. I don't even know who Chris Wright is. But she started singing like a lullaby, like a song. And I remember
on the Rick and Bubba show.
Yeah. And Rick's just looking at me through the glass, like, what are you doing, man? And Bubba, you know, he turns around, he's just like, what's going on?
What are we doing?
And it ended up being the clip that, like, because they pick highlights for the day, right? Through the segment.
Yeah.
It ended up being the segment that they kept for the day. It's the highlight. Because it just turned into just this laughing stock.
They could just make fun of anything.
And she was super sweet. It actually was that they said that Chris Wright told her to call when I thought it said Chris Rock told her to call.
Lord.
Just a classic.
Yeah.
That's just a day in the life of me, actually. I have this gift, but I also have this other clumsy gift that I can never escape. And this happens to me regularly. So
you're working at Rick and Bubba. you transitioned into what kind of video job after that?
AL.com, the Birmingham News, they were putting together a team of some creatives. They were hiring three initial video producers.
Okay.
And when I saw that, I went crazy. They were like, we're going to give you a budget to have camera gear, and you'll come in and you'll get to create whatever you want.
What?
And in my mind, I'm like, this is a dream. And I remember having a meeting with the director at that time, and, you know, I remember we met at Urban Standard on 2nd Avenue North outside, sitting down, dressed up. I might have wore a tie. And, you know, he was just such a cool dude. He was like, we're looking for talented people. I put together a demo reel, which you had to have.
Yeah.
Like, video is like kind of standard to have, like, sure, a demo reel to show your work. I was putting together like stuff I'd shot in film school, wedding stuff. Literally went out and just shot like some cars, like at car meetups, just to like put together something cool.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if I was going to get hired, but he hired three main core producers, video producers, at Alameda Media Group. And that started a whole new world of video at AL.com. They never did video before.
Wow.
They were the first. And that turned into It's a Southern Thing.
Yeah.
If you've seen any of those videos.
I have.
SEC Shorts.
Yeah.
All sprung from this same core group. We had Alabama football highlights from Auburn and Alabama. We covered like UAB football.
Would you go shoot at the game and then pull like content after that?
Yeah. We'd even shoot the video where Nick Saban is speaking. You've got to get the camera set up so it's recording. And as soon as it gets done, I've got to go and upload it and make sure the sound's good and send it to the reporter that's writing about it and have it up on AL.com's website within 15 minutes, which is so scary.
Wow. So did you enjoy that kind of work? Because that's not what you do now.
I did, man. I loved it because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know if I was supposed to be an editor, a director, cinematographer, a photographer. I mean, like, that place allowed me to just open up my mind and work with other creatives.
Sure.
You know, when I went to film school, I didn't really talk about this, but a lot of the folks that went there all thought that they were Quentin Tarantino, or they were the director, they were the shooter, they were. So I kind of like was behind the scenes a lot. I mean, our final project was to shoot a film and write it, all that stuff. And I just remember reading the dialogue and be like, nobody says this stuff. And so being me, I just don't like the politics of it. So I was like, can I still pass if I shoot the behind the scenes of this and make my own video? So literally made my own thing and still passed.
How about that?
And it was great. And I did end up being one of the editors on the short film because it was, I mean, it had some help. It did help me figure out what I was going to be
good
at, you know, what I was, because I was doing so many different things there. But I never really found a niche there. Never really found.
I tell people all the time, those first jobs that we have, what they do is they tell us really, really quickly, I really like this. But they also tell us really, really quickly, I really, really hate this. Mm-hmm. And so the beginning stages of all these jobs that we have as kids, there's, you know, Sierra, who's over there behind the camera. She's got two girls. And I looked at her daughter, who interned for us. And I looked at her and I said, hey, look, you're either going to really love this or really, really hate this. Mm-hmm. And both of them are wins.
Nice.
You got to figure out what it is you like. And it's okay to take these jobs at the Walmart, you know, doing the pictures in and out at AL.com and whatever, but figuring out, because you do so many different things, you figure out what you like and what you don't like.
Yeah.
So that's critical. So
I mean, when I graduated from film school, I had this little baseline ego that I needed to get rid of. And it was just as if I was thrown into this scenario to level me out. And I didn't realize it then, obviously, because there was no talking me out of anything, talking me into anything. So Once I realize that now, it's crafted me to be how I can create today, and like allowed me to actually have the talents.
Yeah,
because I wouldn't have gotten them if I skipped ahead.
No,
not even for a second.
No.
Yeah, you learn in the dirt.
Sure. Now, where did you go from working at AL.com?
Worked at AL.com and then got into the agency world.
Yeah.
I was specializing. When I was at AL.com, I was specializing what I was going to do, and everyone was hiring. They called me the beauty shooter.
Okay.
So, like, I could never finish a project on my own because I would spend too much time on an edit or spend too much time trying to shoot extra things. And my boss would always, Justin Yerkinen, he would always be like, hey man, when's that piece going to get done? He was such a cool boss, but like never, ever followed through. And not fully. I mean, I did have some core pieces, and the core pieces I did finish, they won awards, but they took a while. But most of the team members were, they were really quick at coming up with a concept, writing script, shoot, delivery, and have it done in 48 hours.
That's not you.
Yeah, that wasn't me. Well, it's because I was afraid to let it out there. I mean, I'm working for this news organization.
Yeah.
And as soon as I let it out there, it's like the world sees it. But yeah. The truth is, it's hit or miss.
Sure.
Then, you know, 10,000 people might see it. 200 people might see it.
Yeah.
A million people might see it. Maybe. But when I was there, I did break through some of that fear. And I didn't really like the style of what they were doing. It was more of that socially friendly kind of content.
Right.
And like comedy.
Yeah.
And I just like, I wanted something beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, like I love the art of cinematography and just the energy behind it and like slow motion. Like I'm the guy that will sit there and watch a wall like with it paint, like just dry.
You know,
like,
sure.
It's like, dang, look at that. You know, like, and
let's
like,
get the video on camera.
Like, what the heck is going on here? Yeah. So like I do that with like anything. Like my, like there will be moments, and that's probably where my ADHD comes from, is I'll just be looking at something like, God, that's just the lights hitting it just a certain way. I mean, like if I walk into a coffee shop, I don't just like go straight to the register. I'm like, I'm reading the entire room.
You're an observer.
Energy in it. Yeah. And I'm.
Do you look around when you drive?
I do, but you know, driving is so second nature now. It just.
When I drive, my wife gets on me all the time. Don't let there be any water anywhere.
Yeah.
Because if it's water, I'm looking.
Yeah.
I'm not obviously near as creative as you are, but like, I am the same way. I walk into a place, I look at the chairs, the architecture, the paint, the whatever.
You're gonna
just notice it.
You're gonna need a Tesla for Iceland, because that's all you could do is stare every place you go. It's absolutely beautiful.
So let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got a video on your Instagram where you and your wife or fiance are in Iceland, and it is such a good video. It goes from just walking to ice walking with these cleats on to on top of a van, to diving in. I know it's got to be freezing cold water, to like all of these things. So tell me quickly about that trip and what, like just the inspiration behind that video.
Man, I was wanting to go to Iceland for so long. Like I always thought that I was going to be like this like world like traveler that would just shoot and just create like content and capture like Nat Geo style.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, the avenues that I was going through at that time. And, you know, we went to Iceland 3 years ago. So we're fast forwarding really, really,
yeah,
really, really fast here. And Iceland got really popular, where it was almost kind of like, I didn't want to go, you know, but I couldn't afford to go. I couldn't actually line things up. And there were so many things that got in the way. And so, and I do believe it was all kind of perfect.
Yeah.
Cause then when I met my fiance, I told her about Iceland. She'd never even really heard of Iceland.
Wow.
You know, she's like, and she doesn't like the cold. You know, she's Mexican.
Yeah.
She wants to be below the equator. She right. wants a margarita and be on the beach,
sure, or
dancing to.
Sounds like my kind of girl.
Yes, exactly. And she is such a huge supporter. She's like, let's go. Let's do it. Like, book it. Let's go. So I worked out a barter with Go Campers up there. And that's something I do all the time now, is I barter for content. And
was that the van that you used?
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yeah, and it was great. It was four-wheel drive. I mean, you could take that thing anywhere. It had a kitchen. The only thing it didn't have is a shower, but that was fine, because the way that Iceland's so set up, it's just one big circle. And every 30 miles, there's a campsite, and you just roll up, you plug in if you need to, and they have these really nice, clean, hot showers. And they even have like a kitchen where you can cook, and then you just move to the next spot.
Just keep going.
Mm-hmm. And everything in Iceland's absolutely beautiful. I mean, like
the video, I mean, like I've watched it over and over again. And like, I've sent it to people. Like this is, I think I sent it to my wife. I said, this is the guy that we're having on. This guy's awesome. I've known him for a while, but this guy's awesome. Look at this.
Yeah,
and so, the things that you do are pretty awesome. So I think we met when you worked for BJ and Cliff at Telegraph. So you're at Telegraph. This is probably six or seven years ago.
Yeah.
You're at Telegraph. You work with those guys. I love BJ. Love Cliff. Those guys are wonderful human beings. But here's of late, you have are a co-founder at Supernaut. Mm-hmm. So you transitioned into owner, mm-hmm. worked for people for a long time. You've obviously done the freelance stuff. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the transition from being a W-2 employee to being an owner and why that took place.
Man. Well, the transition's scary when you go off on your own.
Oh, it is.
I know that the first initial thought for anybody in that position is I get to do what I want, make my own schedule. Mm. But you're literally writing your own story at that point.
Wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't, when you get to a certain point after many years and many hours, but for a long time, bro, you don't have a boss. Mm-hmm. You got 40 bosses.
Yeah.
Because the client in those situations is your boss.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, you're fine. Down. Yeah. So, I mean, Telegraph was a great experience. I got to connect with so many people and collaborate, which I never really got to do, like on more long form content.
Yeah.
And that just allowed my brain to just kind of like, you know, see that like, oh, I can delegate out tasks. I got put in a director's role where I've got like people below me now. And, you know, if they don't come in on time, like, am I going to be the cool boss? As long as I get their work done, you know, like there were so many things that I learned. But then there was a lot of things I didn't see, you know, like, you know, from the top tier, like, you know, obviously the president being and the CEO with, you know, Cliff and BJ, and they were great leaders. The biggest thing for me was, man, I don't like doing, I can't be tamed.
Sure.
I probably created some ruffled some feathers just on timeline, you know, because they would say, hey, we need this piece by this time, this client's, and I'm like, and I'd be like if I'm like Neo, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to be there when I get it.
Yeah. And in a way, I felt like, you know, you know, they're like, well, they didn't really push back, which is so great. Like they worked with me, but I remember just, it was so important that the art just stay preserved.
Sure.
And also it's got my name on it. So like when I get a, you know, if we've got a client that is like, we want it yesterday and they've got a budget, I get it. We've got a business. We got to keep it running. If that's the case, I'm like, I'm not thinking about the money. I'm just thinking this is going to have my name on it at the end of the day. And I would be the guy at the office, even though we had, 48 hours to finish a project, get it out the door. I was there till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And for me, they're like, hey, you didn't need to put all that time into it, you know? But for me, it's like, as soon as this leaves, it's my reputation.
It's yours.
And so for me, like the transition was, I wanted to have control as a creative to be my own, like control my own destiny in terms of the products I create and what I'm working on.
Right.
And it was, you know, when you work at any agency, and this isn't, you know, news to anybody that's into the marketing world, it is very revolving and it's always constantly moving. And it's like, as soon as you wrap up a project, you think you're going to breathe, but then you look at your calendar and you've got these AEs that are telling you, oh, well, hey, good job on that, but we've got these projects that are on hold and you've got to get going on it and I need to be briefed on it. And I hadn't met with the owners of these companies and they're like, oh, we already met with them, but like, here's what you need to do. And I wanted to work with a company. Shannon and I, like we both worked there and we did get, you know, we accomplished a lot there and we had some great relationships, but I think we looked internally and saw like, hey, we just kind of want to control more in terms of like what projects we do and how much time we have. So now when we meet with clients, we do this disclaimer, you know, it's like, hey, this is what it's going to cost.
Yep.
This is how long it's going to take. And if they want to work with us, they'll wait for it.
Great.
Yeah.
If not, that's fine too.
Exactly. And you know, we've had some people say we don't want that and that's fine. Yeah. And that's just the nature of the beast. But with that, it comes with, you know, not having as much work at first. And we were fortunate to lock in a couple of bigger companies here in Birmingham that has allowed us to give us that creative freedom because they trust it and they saw the work and they know what it needs to kind of like nourish that.
Right.
And it keeps us level.
Mm.
And that, But we couldn't scale. We couldn't have 40 employees like Telegraph did.
Correct.
You know, if we did, we'd drown. And they've got that many employees. You've got to feed all those people. You got to make sure that they've got jobs coming, which makes sense that you would have, you know, all that work.
The revolving door.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so, like, you can control it when you have three core players. And the way that Supernaut works is we are a creative collective that is literally creative forward. Like, the creatives are in the room. We are in all the meetings. And if you were to come to me and say, hey, I would love a video, you're going to meet the writer. You're going to meet the 3D guy. You're going to meet the director. We're all going to be on the same page. Because the game of telephone in the creative world is, I would say, almost like a cancer. You could have an AE, somebody that's not creative, have a conversation with the client and write down all the notes. And then take those notes to meet with us. And they'll be like, oh, he wants this. But like the interpretation of it, it's already lost just right there in that moment. So we wanted to fix that.
Well, there's a lot to of how someone says something.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone, you can hear someone's deepest like desires when they talk about whatever that thing is.
Mm-hmm.
And you know when they are, I hate the word passionate, but you know when someone's really deeply moved by a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make sure that you capture that. So video is extremely impactful. Mm-hmm. Video movies has a way of making us stop, making us take a breath. So the question I have is, what is one of the most like unexpected ways your content has impacted someone's life, you think?
I think just doing exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Taking a moment to be present.
Yeah.
And realizing, like, if it's an event that I captured and they were there.
Yeah.
And they didn't see it the way that I saw it. And what were they doing during that time? Were they have a beer in their hand? Were they just like yelling?
Yeah.
Did they take a time to like sit back and be like, oh crap, look at that crazy vanilla sky over that stage right now. We're in Birmingham. We're, you know, like, this is awesome. Like, I'm that guy that sees it, takes it, bottles it, and then releases it to the world. Be like, oh shit, that was awesome.
That's awesome. So let's tell you another direction, but in the same vein, if you could erase one piece of content that you've made, what would it be and why?
Oh man, if I could erase, I wouldn't erase anything. I would, because it's part of part of growing.
Yeah.
Like if I looked at to me, erasing content is a piece of failure, something I view as a setback in my life.
Mm.
It's like a baby. You create something and, you know, you got to love them.
Yeah.
Even if they're not your favorite.
Sure.
You know, like, and there's something you learn from it. So I hate that I can't answer that question, but.
But you did. Mm. And that's good. So. Just like the viewing of content and video is extremely emotional, what's one of the darkest moments you've experienced in this journey of creating this content?
The darkest moments. I would say that I've always had this passion to be a photojournalist on the side. I'm always experimenting. But the first time I really experienced like the highest level of emotion at its peak was in Birmingham when they had the riots and the protest and like, you know, smashing windows. I mean, I was in the thick of it. I was just capturing and shooting these, like one of the most powerful shots that I got, and you could barely see it because it was so dark, was this mother, you know, pulling her child with her. She's probably six. And she's just seeing all this, you know, people lighting, you know, statues on fire.
Wow.
And the fear in her eyes. I was like, this is going to live with her.
Sure.
And I think for me, the darkness was that everyone was in pain.
Mm.
I didn't feel so much anger. I just felt pain for why they were doing what they were doing. I don't have, you know, a true perspective because my family didn't come with that background.
Yeah.
You know, like I experienced it in high school sometimes when, you know, if I dated a girl and her parents found out that I was mixed, they'd be like,
hey,
shut that down.
What's your grandmother going to say?
That's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, no doubt.
But we've moved past it. But like at the end of the day, it was dark in that sense, but what was powerful about it, because I do believe that everything that is that has darkness has a lighter side, sure. and a very, like, you know, there's a reason for it. And when I released those images, it was almost like the people that kind of made fun of them, the people that were down there protesting, saw the pain.
Mm.
And so it wasn't so much about, you know, silly folks going down there, you know, tearing up the streets. They saw, like, the sadness in their anger and in their eyes.
Yeah.
And I felt it. And I just remember feeling, wow, I've never felt like this.
Yeah.
And I get to witness it.
Yeah.
So.
That's pretty awesome. So one of the things I like to tell people is just imagine you and I are in a coffee shop and there's no cameras around. It's hard for you because you love the cameras as far as just the tech and the fun.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Is there a story that you're afraid to tell through content? Something just like, hey, I don't touch that. What's a story that you're afraid to tell?
Oh, man, that's a good question. That's a really good question. The consequences of telling a story is what scares me. Because I feel like the world's gone crazy right now. It feels like as if it's on fire in terms of how people are reacting instead of taking a step back and thinking and just being more reactive. So I would say that if I were to create any kind of content that would scare me, it would be to dive into a political piece that would be misunderstood.
Sure.
And then I'd have a target on my back.
Mm.
And then my family would have a target on its back.
Yeah.
And so that scares me.
The consequences of creating something that could be construed in a different way.
Exactly. But I do believe that with powerful storytelling, as long as you're authentic with that approach, and which, like, my dream, and I've actually had this in my soul since I started creating, is that one day I do want to create something that, I guess, two ideas or two perspectives or that are completely opposite, polar opposites. They couldn't be any further apart. The content or the piece that I create views both sides objectively, but then brings a bridge so that they can see each other and respect both sides. And then that way you'd be able to change.
Very different from what we see today.
Yeah.
Very
it's all very like he said, she said, and then they manipulate it to sound a certain way.
Yeah.
But there's just so much. I was actually talking about this with my friends the other day about like how you can go and watch a movie and one person to the right of you could be just like, oh, this is the best movie ever. But to the left, the other person feels nothing.
Right.
It's the worst movie ever. And they just assume you create this consideration that like everyone in this theater must feel the same way as I do. And then this person to the right is like, yeah, everybody. And then as soon as you get out of the theater and you're like, finish up the rest of your popcorn, they're like, man, that movie sucked. And you're like, what?
What?
It's like, did we watch the same movie?
Were you the same?
Dude, that's the same with everybody with conversations.
Sure.
You could be at a dinner party and sitting down and someone could be talking and, you know, everyone's listening to this, maybe this one person that's concerned. And, you know, from one perspective, you could be thinking like, oh, that guy's being authentic and awesome. And I don't really believe in what he's shooting for, but like, I don't see where he's coming from. And then you got this other person that's just only hung up on one thing that he said and they hadn't listened to anything else. And then they go and they talk. And then they go and they talk. And it's just this perspective that, you know, everyone sees the world just and hears the world in a different way.
Yeah.
And you never know what kind of mess you're going to get into.
Never know what someone's going to think. Yeah. So I think in some ways you have a very, very difficult job.